Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Welcome this morning. We're here to talk about the political and budget outlook for the 113th Congress and what matters to you, the Fed employee. And to lead us in that discussion are two PhDs, Susan Ligon, Senior Fellow, the Georgetown Government Affairs Institute, correct?
Correct.
Did I do that right? And Dr. Ken Gold, Director, the Government Affairs Institute of Georgetown, right?
Yep.
Am I doing that right?
You're doing it perfect.
Okay. And Tammy Flanagan, I think I got this one down. Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
It's been 6 weeks since you've been on, huh?
It's been a while. Wow. Yeah, I took a little winter break, I guess.
Okay, good for you. All righty. So
I was furloughed.
Let's hope not. All righty. Tell us why we should be worried about furloughed or whatnot, and who leads off?
Sue, so you want to lead off and talk about the political situation which led us here?
Sure. I guess the thing to say is that the 113th is going to be a whole lot like the 112th Congress, only more so. After the election, we wind up with pretty much the same dynamic we had before, with Republicans in control of the House, Democrats in the Senate, and Obama in the White House. And while Democrats made a few gains, I think we remain a 50-50 nation, and I wish I had better news for federal employees, but I think we're in a permanent campaign where both parties think that the majority is within their reach. They just have to wait for the other side to mess up so badly so quickly that they'll look good again in comparison. So there are lots of reasons for that. I think it's interesting to most people that you hear surveys about Congress's popularity and that Congress is now actually less popular than root canals, NFL replacement referees, and colonoscopies, yet better than 90% in the House and 95% in the Senate are reelected. So that leads people to think, why? And there's a simple explanation for this. There are fewer and fewer competitive districts in the House. And the reason for that is in part because of redistricting, not so much the number of seats that flip, but what we have are redder red districts and bluer blue districts. And the upshot of all of this is for many running for reelection, they don't really fear the general election. The other party isn't a threat. It's the fear of a primary that's the threat. So they have to establish their bona fides with their base, which means they become that much more extreme, which means they resist compromise.
If we look back in history, has there been a time where there's been this 50-50, nothing seems to get through as quickly as it used to? I'm not a political beast, so I'm going to hand that off to you. Has there been a time like that?
Well, there's certainly been times where Congress has been ineffective or times when things have been contentious. I think the interesting thing now is that it's been such a prolonged period. Most analysts began in 2000 with this 50-50 nation idea, and certainly the election of 2012 only amplified those differences. I think there are very clear regional, racial, age-based, gender-based, and ideological differences in the electorate. And the interesting thing is not just that they're enduring, but that both sides are sort of equally matched. And that, again, plays to this no incentive on either side to compromise. Usually we think half a loaf is better than none. And certainly when we're talking about things like the sequester or any of the continuing resolutions or any of the other things that are on Congress's plate right now, most of us would think, well, you know, surely they can find some way to compromise. But electorally, for many of these people, compromise is the same as surrender. And for the others, compromise means wait them out until they come around to do what. I think we are sort of in an unprecedented time period now.
Call me naive. I'm not a political beast, but, you know, I hear about the old smoke-filled rooms where the president would call, or the Congress would call the president over and say, hey, let's sit in this room until we come up with some kind of decent compromise. Are those days gone?
Well, I think they're not. I think it's a lot harder to do. And there are a couple reasons. One is, in the old days, people used to respect the idea that if you were a fairly senior and in a leadership position, you were a force to be reckoned with. And I think those days are gone now. I mean, now, you know, if you have a Twitter feed and want to go on cable television or on radio stations, you develop your own power base. So the smoke-filled room, I prefer to think of it as the old-style deal. And I think you've got a great example of that with the fiscal cliff, when you had these two old senators who'd worked together for years, who knew each other, you know, McConnell and Biden, coming up with a deal and shaking hands. And it wasn't quite the old days where they do it over bourbon and branch water in the smoke-filled room, but it was, you know, the old-style deal. And one would like to think that that can still happen. Given the personnel now, I think it's hard. And one reason is you've got so many new guys who don't have much institutional loyalty. For example, a third of the House was elected in 2010 or 2012.
Wow.
And on the Senate side, a third of them have served 2 years or less. In fact, about half are still serving their first term. So the learning curve is pretty steep, and there's not a lot of respect for, look, we need to actually legislate. I think the reason for that is the permanent campaign. You know, if you think you're about to get all of the cookies, you're not as willing to accommodate the other side. And here, this is a classic tension, I think, between electoral politics, where you've got to draw the line in the sand and appeal to your base and be wildly partisan, and legislative politics, which by definition requires compromise.
So how much have you seen social media influence what's been going on with the voters being politicized into different parties because of so much of that peer pressure?
That's a great question, and I wish I had the exact quote. That Congressman Greg Walden, who was just recently elected to leadership on the Republican side in the House, is a congressman from actually my parents' district in eastern Oregon. And he said, in the old days, you know, you did something, it would matter in your own media market. Now, any member of Congress does something, it matters in about 30 seconds and 140 characters to everyone else.
Everybody, even around the world.
Around the world. So, you know, there are no secrets anymore, and we've seen that in terms of campaigning. But I think it makes it tougher to get to those deals if you're worried that, you know, someone is going to leak any information. I think there are some deals that are probably within reach. At least I like to hope that's the case. But until such time as there's incentive to reach those deals, I'm afraid we're going to have this 11th hour, best we can do, leadership forces it on their rank and file, take it or leave it kind of legislating, which is certainly not what the founders intended.
Okay, you and Ken are experts in your field, but I'm not so sure all the listeners, including the one talking, understands the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. What is it?
We were created in 1965 by Congress, initially part of the United States Civil Service Commission, with the mission of educating executive branch personnel about Congress and how to work more effectively with Congress. In 1995, GAI was privatized by the federal government, and we became part of Georgetown University. We are part of the Georgetown Public Policy Institute, but our mission is identical to that for which we were created in 1965, and that is educating executive branch personnel about Congress. About 98% of the participants in our classes are federal employees. We do programs for a slate of federal agencies as well. And that's what we do. We think that our mission is to educate every executive branch employee, especially managers and executives, so that they have a better understanding of how Congress works. And we believe that the system only works when both of the branches understand the others. So communication is essential, and understanding the culture and structure and processes of each of the branches is integral to that.
In your instruction, do you also talk about statistics that, okay, this is the way things were voted on given this issue, and do history as well as projecting into the future based on the makeup of Congress?
Well, we do a bit of history, but as a backdrop to understanding the current context of the Congress, but our focus really is on the present and practical knowledge for federal personnel that's useful to them in making them more effective managers and executives.
Which members of the federal workforce do you mostly speak to? Is it people who have to actually appear before Congress and testify, or is it just the people in human resources or...
Yeah, we do teach people how to testify before Congress. It's one of the workshops that we offer. We also offer workshops on communicating and with Congress in various ways on various parts of the budget and appropriations process. But most of the federal personnel we teach are not going to testify themselves, although some portion of them do. It's sort of the middle managers, upper managers, executives who have some responsibilities with respect to Congress. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, all of them do, because every appropriated federal dollar is approved by Congress.
Absolutely.
The executive branch has no money to spend unless Congress appropriates that money, and no programs unless Congress authorizes those programs.
So a lot in the budget process deals with what Congress is going to approve, and that, as you said, directly affects the agencies and how they spend their dollars and what they spend them on.
Very much so, and we think it's very important that individual agencies be skilled at representing their programs to Congress and educating Congress about what they do so Congress can make better educated decisions about which programs to continue, which programs to cut, which programs to increase, and in times of budget cutbacks, which we're obviously in, that function is that much more essential.
Right.
As with so many new members, a lot of these folks come from outside public service altogether. They just don't know what agencies do. They've heard of them, but as I say, the learning curve is pretty steep, and there are all sorts of private interests that are eager to bring them up to speed. So our mission is to make sure that the federal workforce has a sort of a seat at the table and knows how the place operates. I find myself, we teach courses on Capitol Hill, and I find myself beginning them by saying, you don't have to like Congress, but it behooves you to understand them. Not only do they fund you, but particularly in this Congress, there's going to be an awful lot of oversight of agency activity, regardless of funding. And they can reorganize, as anyone who works in the Department of Homeland Security knows all too well. So you got to understand these guys if you want to work effectively.
Now, and speaking with them, some agencies, so I understand, I don't understand this like you all do, but there's duplicative efforts, if you will, or programs, and this program might be somewhat the same thing in one agency versus another. Do you ever talk about that in your classes and say, well, if you do this, I remember the movie Dave. I don't know if you remember Dave, where he sat down. I'm not saying this because he sat down with his accountant, because I am one. But they balanced the budget. Well, we don't need that. We don't need that. Do you have a course on that, money dynamics, if you will? If we're spending X dollars here and X dollars there for the same thing, which is the winner and which one gets cut?
In a sense, everything we do addresses that. And it goes back to the point of the need to educate members of Congress and congressional staff about what the departments and agencies do. And those departments and agencies and programs that can make their case more strongly before Congress are the ones that will be authorized and appropriated funds for. And those that can't will see their programs cut. And that is the responsibility of public officials, to educate members of Congress and congressional staff about why their programs are important.
So I was watching Iron Man last night, and Iron Man was testifying in front of Congress. I don't know if you remember the scene, and he's shot. Anyway, so do you prep people to testify at Congress? And if you do, because you're saying yes, do you arm them with the ability for statistics and graphs? And
we do.
Because
we do.
Today's a visual world as well as a verbal.
We do. And in fact, I think it's probably one of the most valuable things we can do for people, because congressional hearings are unlike any other presentation. This isn't like speaking to your board. It's not like speaking to the assistant secretary or doing a briefing. It's their show. And so we try to equip people to do as well as they can. With statistics, I'll put this out there as a little plug. If you're interested in this, we urge you to consider taking our course for the rest of it. But we tell people a good statistic can really make a presentation, but you've got to use it sparingly. And we'll tell people, instead of giving numbers, give real life examples, something that people can relate to. Instead of talking about, you know, a dollar figure, put it in terms of, you know, gallons of gas or average rent or what have you. We'll also tell people nothing can kill a presentation faster than too many numbers and the eyes glaze over. So we do tell people, of course, coming up with the data is their
job.
Effort. But I think a lot of times federal employees are so accustomed to having to be accountable and making sure that they document things, which you can appreciate as an accountant, I'm sure, that they get a little lost in the weeds. And when you're testifying before Congress, you know, you don't have many opportunities to leave something that's going to stick. And the member, meanwhile, is thinking about, you know, okay, do I have a fundraiser tonight? Where am I going for lunch? Am I supposed to be at that other hearing right now? What's going on my phone? You know, it's
difficult. You need to grab their attention.
You do. Mm-hmm. And statistics can be a great way of doing that. Or a good story that puts a face on something. But I don't want to give away all of our secrets, but suffice it to say that when we do this course, people invariably tell us they wish they'd done it earlier in their career. And we get some fan mail on occasion from people who say they couldn't have done it without us, which is very gratifying.
Do you have courses available that people can sign up to attend, or do you tailor the course to their needs?
We have both, and they can sign up for classes on our website. By the way, we advised Iron Man to wear the suit to the hearing, thinking that would be a good attention grabber.
We should mention the website, too. There are no W's. It's just gai.georgetown.edu, and all of our courses. It's gai.georgetown.edu.
Okay. Did you get a suit from Iron Man?
No.
Okay. Anyway, sorry, but I just fresh in my memory him testifying in front of Congress.
We do give advice on what to wear, though. We do. No dangling earrings. No, you know.
Really?
Yeah. No ties that are going to be painful on TV. But like I say, I don't want to give away all of our secrets.
Okay. We won't do that. Actually, Mike Causey gave us some emails in prep for the show. And one of these might just fit in nicely here. And it says, I'm a longtime reader and appreciate your service to federal employees. I'm a controller in a DOD organization that has over 200 civilian employees. As you can imagine, there's a lot of angst about the political furlough looming. I have to state, however, that DOD may be crying wolf about the end to have a furlough because of what might happen. The effect of it will amount to only a 10% cut for our fiscal year 13 budget. Anyway, so it goes on to say, I think the gist of what it is maybe it's not as bad as it appears to be.
It's interesting that the questioner called it a political furlough. I haven't heard that term before, but I would agree with that term, in fact, in that this issue is more a political issue than it is a budget issue. Certainly, there are budget issues. We have a $16.5 trillion debt. We've had trillion-dollar-plus deficits running the last 3 years. We have interest on the debt that is consuming a larger and larger portion of the budget. It's estimated that by 2022, in less than 10 years, that interest on the debt will comprise 11% of the federal budget by the Congressional Budget Office. It's also estimated that entitlement programs, mandatory programs, the big three being Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, will comprise another 64% of the budget.
64%?
64%. Yeah. So those doing the math add 64% for mandatory spending, 11% for interest on the debt. That leaves only 25% for discretionary spending, everything else, all defense and non-defense departments and agencies, only 25% of the budget. Now, only 2 years ago, discretionary spending made up 40% of the federal budget. So this is putting a tremendous squeeze on the discretionary side of the federal budget, where not only civilian personnel, but military personnel costs are involved as well. GAO estimates that by 2025, in 12 years, that entitlement spending, mandatory programs that I mentioned, plus interest on the debt, will consume 100% of federal revenue. That means that any spending that's done on the discretionary side will come all from borrowing. Wow. So these pressures are very real. On the other hand, as the questioner points out, this is a political issue right now between Democrats and Republicans. The sequester is scheduled for 4 days from now, and every source is saying that the sequester will happen. And so those $85 billion in cuts will kick in. But how they kick in is really an open issue at this point. The White House is trying to portray the cuts as being devastating and immediate and is talking about furloughs, while the Republicans in Congress are trying to say nobody's really going to notice it all that much. And the truth in this case is probably somewhere in between, that there are requirements regarding furloughs that mean that furloughs would start at the earliest at the beginning of April and more likely toward the end of April if nothing is done to forestall the sequester. The other event that's coming up that probably is going to press things more closely is the end of the continuing resolution on March 27th. So the entire federal government right now is funded by a continuing resolution that kept spending at roughly FY12 levels of spending through the first 6 months of FY13. And that's coming to a head on March 27th. So the real question is, what happens with the end of the continuing resolution? Do they pass another continuing resolution to fund the government through the end of the fiscal year or possibly even the end of the calendar year? Right now, they're talking about a good possibility of passing two FY13 appropriations bills, the one for defense and the one for military construction, veterans affairs, with the rest being wrapped up into an omnibus of some kind that will fund the government through the end of the fiscal year, with some provisions that make exceptions to spending at FY12 levels. We still haven't even begun to address the FY14 appropriations bills. And normally, at this time of year, we'd be well into considering the FY14 appropriations bills, with the FY13 bills expiring at the end of September, and we're not even close to doing that.
Could I ask you to go back to the comment you made before those stats? What was it, 11% interest and 64% Medicare, Medicaid, Medicare?
Right, and that's projected by the Congressional Budget Office by 2022.
Okay, and the interest rates, I assume they put into their formula escalating interest rates.
The interest rate projections are fairly conservative, but given the fact that short-term interest rates on government bonds are at zero now, the chances are great that they'll go up. And the average interest rates on government debt is about 2%. You contrast that with during the Carter administration, when the interest rates on government debt was about 9%. And that was a time in which
almost
we were seeing
digit.
Interest card debt at 25%. Mortgages were at 22%. And so interest rates will go up. But the other issue with that, of course, is the principal. So right now we have a $16.5 trillion debt. We have been adding to that the annual deficits at the rate of about $1 trillion a year. There is some good news in that CBO is projecting that the deficits will be more in the order of $500 billion a year over the next 10 years. Now, that still means adding another $5 trillion to the debt, so the debt approaching $22 trillion. And even with lower interest rates, as that principal continues to grow, the amount of net interest we pay on that debt continues to grow.
Okay. I remember, during the Clinton administration, wasn't there a balanced budget in there at one point?
It was a 1 year of a balanced budget and 3 years of budget surpluses. And just prior to that balanced budget occurring, economists were projecting deficits as far as the eye could see. And we had a sudden turnaround. Much of that turnaround was due to a runaway economy. All of a sudden, things got really healthy. And so because of the economy and because of the tax code, because there were tax increases passed
during the Clinton administration. That translated into a great deal more revenue coming into the Treasury Department, and therefore surpluses. And for a short while, we were looking at surpluses as far as the eye could see. The original rationale for the 2001-2003 tax cuts, which became known as the Bush tax cuts, was that we had this enormous surplus and we needed to give some of this money back to the people who it really belonged to. By the time we were passing those tax cuts, especially the 2003 tax cuts, we were already looking at deficits as far as the eye could see. And so projections that are very frightening, like the ones that I related from the Congressional Budget Office and GAO, can change very quickly. There were two bits of good news last week. The beginning of the week, the Congressional Budget Office revised its deficit projection for 2013 downward to $875 billion, which will be the first time that it falls below a trillion dollars in 4 years. And further projections looking at deficits in the range of $500 billion. The second development last week was on Friday, the CBO revised downward its projection for Medicare costs over the next 8 years. And they revised their projection downward by $400 billion. Now, that's larger than what the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommended in cuts to Medicare. And so these projections can change and will change. Some of it will depend in large part on the economy. So if we see a economy that starts to get healthier, more revenues come in, but we've made changes to the tax code by continuing 82% of the Bush-era tax cuts, we've put the government in a much less favorable position to add revenue even with an exploding economy.
I have to interject here since I'm the politics portion of this duo and Ken's giving you the budget. I completely agree, which is a good thing because he's my boss, about the Clinton era and the economy taking off. But that was the dot-com boom, so somewhat short-lived. The other thing is, politically, while it's true that the years of surplus were accomplished largely because you had President Clinton, who was willing to tackle things like welfare reform, and you had the Republican Congress that was willing to cut spending, there was a little of both. And I think many in Congress would blame those tax increases on the reason that Democrats lost the House for the first time in 40 years because they voted for those tax increases. So, you know, members of Congress being elected officials are not eager to increase taxes. And I think in this instance, with the fiscal cliff deal, the Republican line is, look, we gave it the cliff deal. You know, we got nothing in spending cuts, and we certainly got nothing in entitlement cuts. Your turn, Mr. President. You talk about you want a balanced approach. Where's the balance? Because we've given, at least if you think tax increases on those who make $450,000 a year more is a concession, but in their view, certainly it is. So I think the political furlough, perhaps the caller didn't realize just how significant that comment was, but I think it very much is. There's also something I think going on now that we call the fireman first strategy from local governments, where anytime you're threatened, you say the first thing you're going to cut is the fire department. So now it's, you know, planes will be falling out of the sky and your food won't be inspected and all of this kind of thing. And I think Ken's right. The continuing resolution and the possibility of a government shutdown should loom a lot larger than the sequester. You know, like with the big banks, we all heard about too big to fail. I think this one, frankly, is too small to care. And were it not in the sequencing of things, I don't think many people think it's going to go on for a long time. I think it's both sides want to call each other's bluff. And right now it looks like the Republicans will take the blame for this, much as they did in 95 for the government shutdown, despite their protestations to the contrary and despite Bob Woodward saying this was Obama's idea. You know, it was actually Jack Lew's idea.
That was my question on what is the end date for the sequester. It just seems like we keep talking about it's going to happen. Is it just a fiscal year thing, or is it something that's going to continue until somebody stops it?
It's actually over 10 years.
10 years.
And it was part of the 2011 Budget Control Act in which the debt ceiling was raised to January 1st, 2013, or December 31st, 2012, that there was an agreement that they needed to cut a minimum of $1.2 trillion over 10 years. In addition to the cuts that were included in the Budget Control Act, the sequester was put in place as the sword of Damocles that would never happen, that the cuts would be so draconian and so unfair because they'd be across-the-board cuts that surely Congress would do something in the interim to avoid that from happening.
Which they
haven't. Had 17 months in to act in that, and they failed to do so. Now, Congress is very good at acting at the 11th hour. Mm-hmm. In fact, 11 hours and 55 minutes.
So we still have plenty of time.
So the sequester was most recently delayed from January 1 to March 1, and the sequester is scheduled to take place and likely will take place. It's been reduced from $109 billion to $85 billion, but the time period in which it will be executed has been reduced from 9 months to 6 months at this mm-hmm. point. And so the cuts will be more severe. The estimates are that the cuts would be approximately 6% from non-defense discretionary spending and 8% from defense discretionary spending. Within that, military personnel accounts are exempted on the defense side. So the cuts to other defense programs will have to be that much larger, potentially on the order of 14%. Now, this gets into budget wonky stuff because the cuts are actually in budget authority, not in actual spending. And so they can finesse those cuts to a large extent so that about half of them can be pushed into the out years, even with this year's cuts. They need to do something about it because there is still the larger $1.2 trillion that needs to be resolved. So the betting in Washington, the optimistic betting, is that they will agree at some sort of quote-unquote grand bargain that will resolve the long-term deficit crisis in some way, will cancel the sequester for the long term as well as for the short term, and will be some part of an agreement attached to the expiring continuing resolution on March 27th.
Let me ask you a question. We're not in a smoke-filled room because we can't smoke. And Tammy left all the booze at home and brought water. So we're having a meeting. We're Congress. And Sergeant-at-Arms Ann Vincent is looking at us. How do we straighten out this these imbalances?
A great question, and I think if I had the answers to that, I'd probably be at a nice consultancy and not speaking on federal news radio. But I think there are ways to do things, and I think, again, it's the political calculus right now. I think for a lot of Republicans in the House and some in the Senate as well, they feel that they simply cannot go back to their districts and say, look, things would really be serious if we didn't do this with the sequester. In their view, the sequester was something so horrible that it would prompt action, but the action they'd like to see is some sort of meaningful cuts in spending or entitlements. And we all know that cutting discretionary spending for feds is an insignificant way to approach, you know, you could do away with the entire federal discretionary budget. It's not going to solve our problems. No. It really is the entitlement issue. And that's the thing I think everyone is sort of dancing around.
That was my question, Sue. Why aren't we talking about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid? Because just like Ken just said, it's going to take up 100% of our federal budget in just a few years.
Well, and I think we need to be talking about that. But I think we're, ironically, a little too soon into this Congress. I think the president is still kind of basking in the glow of what was a more decisive victory than any of us could have foreseen, except for maybe Nate Silver. But the rest of us certainly didn't see his victory being quite so strong. And no one expected the Senate to pick up two Democratic seats. The House picked up eight. I think right now you see really a unique level of unity among Democrats that protecting entitlements is their primary objective. And the president has told us there are ways that we can go about cuts. And frankly, I think he's quite willing to do so. But I think the political dynamic right now doesn't allow him to. I think so, we have to get past this, you know, the moguls that we have coming with the sequester and the CR and next year's budget. We haven't seen the budget yet, remember? The budget that's supposed to come down at the beginning of February is delayed at least a month. So that will be interesting, too, to see what's in there.
There are differences in the nature of the problems with entitlement programs as well. And not to get too into the weeds on this, but Social Security is very easy to fix.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to fix it about every 15 years or so, and we have.
How do we fix that? Because I was going to
ask. You can't retire at 65. I have to wait till I'm 66. There are more controversial components to that, such as means testing for Social Security.
That was going to be my question.
But, you know, Social Security was created in 1935 with a retirement age of 65 at that time. The life expectancy in 1935 was 64 for men and 66 for women, and that's how they came up with 65. Well, the life expectancy is decades beyond that. And so far, we've managed to get to 66 or 66 in a number of months for people who were born sort of at the tail end of the baby boom generation and younger. We can fix that today. It's a political issue, not a budget issue. Medicare is another problem. Mm-hmm. And what we've done with Medicare, if we've increased the problem. So during the Bush administration, we created Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, which is the largest increase in entitlement programs that we've cast since the Great Society. So this made the problem even worse. So Medicare is a real problem. But suddenly we see decelerating health care costs, and we don't know why they're decelerating. I mentioned that revised CBO projection on the cost of Medicare over the next 8 years, downward from $6.5 trillion to $6.1 trillion. That's $400 billion in savings, which is huge over that period of time. So we know that health care costs are decelerating right now. We think it's partly due to the recession in that people are reluctant, even with health insurance, to go to the doctor when they have a sniffle because they don't want to put out for the copay, and other reasons that people are sort of adjusting to having to pay more for health care and are cutting back on that.
Yeah.
There have been some changes in terms of payments to doctors that have also helped accelerate this. We don't know if this is going to continue at this point, but that could be a huge difference. Interest on the debt is something we can't manage at all. It's due simply to the size of the principal and to interest rates. And so we can't do anything about that either politically or in a budget sense. And that may be the real driver of the problems for discretionary spending over the next 15, 20 years and beyond.
Okay, let's open up the phone lines. I'm sure there are a lot of people that are going to call. don't feel bad if they don't. If we get one, we feel good. If we get five, we faint. So,
well, most of the people who want to call are working right now. So
that's true. But this show is archived, mm-hmm. and it goes up on the net about one or two, and it just takes a spike with the questions from the email. But anyway, let's do the phone. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. All right, let's get back. I find this, I'm not an economist, and I was at this a baby naming party or something. It was full of economists. I mean, big-time economists. And what do I know? So I went around and I said, what do you think the U.S. should do to get out of trouble? And they looked at me like, you got a week? And they said, you can do things, but you'd have to be very careful not to do the wrong thing. And I said, oh, okay. That's as far as I got, because that's as much as I could absorb. But it was just kind of neat being around them, because they spoke in another language that I don't understand. Anyway, but I bet you all would.
There's one thing in my peer group that I hear a lot people saying. Like last week, Congress was out of town. You know, they took a break. And so everyone wants to know, why would Congress take a break when we have this looming crisis of the sequester? So can you explain a little bit about why that happens and what the logic is?
Sure. And again, in my view, this is once again all politics. The fact that they weren't around indicates that they weren't really serious about doing much. And the reason they're not serious about doing much is that both parties are convinced the other is going to bear the blame. You know, the Republicans think, look, this was Obama's idea. He signed the law. You know, this is on his hands. Democrats think once again, Republicans are willing to go not only to the brink but over the cliff and allow something like this to happen because they're incapable of even unifying their own guys. And to some extent, I think the latter is in part true. I think John Boehner is Speaker because nobody else wants the job. It's not a leadership problem. It's a followership problem.
He doesn't
problem.
Look real happy, either.
No, he doesn't. And you know, who can blame the poor guy? It's just not as much fun to be Speaker as it used to be. But I think that the idea that if they're here more, they'd get more done goes along with the, oh, aren't they always on recess mm-hmm. back in their district? And that is a real change now. The expectation that members should be home more has affected a lot of things, including Congress's schedule. They, in the House now, make sure that they're back in the district for at least a week, in their view, because that's how you keep in touch with the folks back
home.
That
you're serving.
Frankly, if they were here, I don't really think it would make much of a difference. I mean, we saw this with the fiscal cliff, where we go through all the dramatics of keeping people around through the winter holidays. And ultimately, it was, you know, two guys who get together and understand what the other needs. Mm-hmm. I tell people the process isn't the problem. The problem is the problem. This is hard. I mean, you're dealing with difficult situations now with an overlay of the political calculation. Who's going to get the blame? And I think Democrats, frankly, can't in good conscience say that we're not going to make any more adjustments in terms of tax revenue and we're just going to let the sequester happen any more than Republicans can say, well, you know, maybe they have a point. Maybe we should just throw up our hands with regard to any spending cuts. Maybe we should just say that entitlements are never going to be addressed. I mean, these are politically untenable positions. And this is what I mean when I say usually we think half a loaf is better than none. In this calculation, it really isn't. You know, sticking to your guns and sort of seeing where the blame will fall is more significant. So I think you can blame Congress for a lot of things, but laziness is not one.
Yeah, yeah, they do seem to work hard.
You mentioned these two seasoned vets getting together. Do you see a group of seasoned vets getting together, but what about the rookies? Are they going to get their back up?
Yes, is a short answer to that question. And I think we've seen this again and again with leadership issues in the Republican Party. You have the author of much of the budget plan from the Republican side, of course, Paul Ryan, former vice presidential candidate, who is back in his job at the top of the budget committee. And, you know, Ryan is a wonk of the first order. And I think he and his counterpart on the other side of the hill, Max Baucus, a Democrat from Montana who's in the budget committee slot, are very conversant. I think if you got them together, I suspect if you put the two of them in a room, I think they probably could come up with something that they could agree to. It's getting the other folks on board. And it's not just the more outspoken Republican newbies here. It's also Democrats in the Senate. You have a much more liberal Democratic caucus and a much more conservative Republican one for the reasons I mentioned earlier. You know, red districts are getting redder, blue are getting bluer. You look at some of the folks who've just come into Congress. You look at Elizabeth Warren for the Democrats and Ted Cruz for the Republicans. You know, these guys have their marching orders and compromise is nowhere in their vocabulary. So there are a lot of demands, I think, on the Democratic side in the Senate saying, look, we just can't give in too much on entitlements. What's the point of having the majority and having had Obama reelected if we're going to have to give in?
Most recently on this issue of avoiding the sequester, the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, punted to the Senate and said, we're not going to do anything. The Senate will have to do it first. And so we will see later this week, perhaps as early as tomorrow, the Senate Democrats have a bill to solve the sequester, and the Senate Republicans have their bill to solve the sequester. Neither will pass. But the Senate Democrats are proposing a 50-50 split in revenue versus spending. President Obama has already conceded a 60-40 split, 60% on spending and 40% on revenue. So you see that the Senate Democrats are more liberal than the White House is on that. So you have that dynamic in addition to the dynamic of the core of the Republican Party in the House, especially the so-called Tea Partiers and their cohorts who say no new tax increases ever, no compromise, we won't vote for anything that has any dimension of new tax increases in it.
When you talk about these the voting being maybe constituent driven, are there any dreamers that say, I got here, I'm going to do this for the better good of the country, and if I don't get elected...
I love this question, because this comes up in all of our courses on the Hill, where we have federal employees from around the country, and they say, you know, what about the public interest? And I respond the way a member famously did on one of our programs, saying, who's public? Yours or mine? You know, the world looks very different from different congressional districts and from different states.
It sure does.
And I think... Believe it or not, I am something of an apologist for the organization, even now, for Congress. These guys represent, and they are representing their district. And I think for those of us who live in Washington, it's hard for us to conceive of the way the world looks in much of the rest of the country.
Yeah, and even economically, because salaries around here are different than the rest of the country, as well as just the way we live our lives.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I think these guys believe what they say. So it's not that, you know, I love that you say that, you know, sometimes constituent driven. I would submit that it's virtually always constituent driven. It's that
but
the constituents.
It be?
Well, I think it should. But there again, you know, the constituents also include major corporations.
Right.
It includes the defense contractor in your district, who has already seen the early ripples from the sequester. I mean, things have been in the pipeline here. Whether or not Congress resolves it, there's been some real hurt already as a result. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that it's difficult. We have a real division between the parties on the nature and role of government. And your economist friends you were talking to, I'm sure most of them would agree that one thing we've got to do is get our credit rating back. You can't have a debt like we have. Ken's given you all the figures and expect that everything is somehow going to magically resolve itself.
Political scientists used to refer to something they called the two Congresses, that Congress has both a legislative function as well as a representative function. And the argument now is that Congress is too representative, that they're driven too much by their constituencies. And this is how we see it manifesting in the leadership problem, especially in the House and John Boehner, in that he doesn't have the levers of leadership that leaders used to have in the Congress, that they're so driven by their own constituencies. They raise their own money. They don't care as much about being appointed to committees as they used to. And so the speaker has a great deal of difficulty in corralling his own members. And so what we saw at the end of the 112th Congress and the very beginnings of the 113th is legislation passing not with a majority, the majority in the House of Representatives, as Speaker Hastert was famous for saying, but with a minority of the majority and a bipartisan coalition of Republicans and Democrats. And so we're seeing some of that happen, and there are some signs for hope that there will be other legislation passed in this manner as well.
Immigration, I think, is the one likeliest prospect now for seeing some real progress. Again, I think a variety of reasons for that, many of them political. I think the time maybe is right, but I think the idea of the sort of the representative nature versus the legislative nature has always been with us. It's amplified now, and in part it's because the party really becomes a little less significant. Outside groups are funding more campaigns, and a lot of votes that are taken now aren't to legislate. They know they have no chance in either chamber. They're for these scorecards that various lobbying groups issue that become the currency of the realm when you're running for re-election. Is, you know, what do your numbers look like from Americans for Democratic Action, or for the AFL-CIO's Committee on Political Education, or from the American Conservative Union, or the National Rifle Association, or any of these? And frankly, those matter a lot. And if your job is on the line, I think the national interest maybe looks a little bit different.
Yeah, the one thing that our people that listen to our show a lot of times are concerned about is what's going to happen to retirement benefits, because we talk a lot, you know, about federal employees' retirement benefits, and we haven't heard a lot of talk. And I guess that's good news that we haven't heard a lot of talk about changing the civil service or the FERS, the new retirement system for government employees, other than for new hires that are coming on board who have to pay more. And I have a feeling they're going to be the ones who are targeted for future changes, but we'll see. Have you heard anything in...
No, it's not being discussed very much, but in terms of just the long-term fiscal health of the ability to pay the unfunded liability of future retirees is true for private corporations, it's true for state and local governments, and it's true for the federal government as well. While they may not make these changes, there is a question, often in the future, of whether there's going to be the money to make these payments that have been promised to them.
Right. But then I guess there was a study done by Congressional Budget Office that said that the Civil Service Trust Fund is good to pay benefits for the next 75 years. And it was designed, the old system, on an unfunded liability way of doing accounting.
Right.
But the new system is funded up front, and it's also well in the black.
So, it is.
So I think that maybe that's why we haven't seen a lot of change.
Okay, we have less than 2 minutes to go. So wrap up comments. Ken, Sue?
Well, I'll give one. I think folks should expect a lot of oversight of their agencies regardless, and I think this is on both sides of the Hill. A lot of regulations coming out now. George Washington University did a study about just how many regulations are likely to be issued forth in the next couple of years. That's going to trigger a whole lot of oversight hearings. And one thing I wanted to mention is on the Senate side, Senator McCaskill has come up with a new permanent financial and contracting oversight subcommittee on the governmental affairs panel. So there are going to be some hearings on the Senate side as well.
Great.
A new poll came out this morning. I saw it in Government Executive, in that federal managers and executives still believe that training federal employees is essential.
Yay.
And we think that
you are the man. You win.
That they need to not be short-sighted and lose the fact of the future of the federal government depends on them being trained.
What a better way to end.
Great ending.
Thank you for both being here from the Governmental Affairs Institute at Georgetown University. And you gave the website earlier, and Andrew's going to cut us off. So we have to get off. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.